I am Platt on the line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. A lot of people dream of wanting to ditch city life and move to the middle of nowhere. In a new memoir, Tom Wayman recounts his own move from Vancouver to southeastern BC deep in the Slocan Valley. With his candid introspection and philosophical insight, Mr. Wayman, who joins me now, provides a moving, sometimes funny, always interesting narration of what rural life was and is like for him in The Road to Appledore, or How I Went to the Land Without Ever Having Lived There in the First Place. We get glimpses in his perceptive writing as to what it's like to live with others in a remote place, even if they're not physically close. There's a certain community that emerges amongst those who live close to nature, not to mention bears or other non-human species. We also see the satisfaction that Tom has in growing his own food as well as flowers that make life itself a little more beautiful. Tom Wayman is the author of 20 poetry collections, 3 collections of critical and cultural essays, 3 books of short fiction, and a novel. He has edited 6 poetry collections as well. In 2022, he received the George Woodcock Award for Lifetime Achievement. In 2015, he was named a Vancouver Literary Landmark with a plaque on Commercial Drive commemorating his championing of people writing for themselves about their daily employment. He also spent many years teaching in both alternative and mainstream post-secondary institutions. Visit his website at tomwayman.com for more. This new book is from Harbor Publishing. We spoke 3 weeks ago. Please welcome to the Platt Online program, Tom Wayman. Mr. Wayman, good morning.
Good morning, and thank you very much for your interest in the book.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you for your time. As I was telling you just before we started, I enjoyed the book a great deal, and I went back to it last night and was reading parts of it again. It's such an enjoyable book because it's not a sort of lifestyle that I'm accustomed to, having grown up in Vancouver. But you lived here for a while, right?
Oh, yeah. I lived a lot of my life in Vancouver. I came in grade 10, and so I did, you know, grade 10, 11, 12, and 4 years of university, and then went away and then came back for many years. So a big chunk of my life was in Vancouver. When I was at university, I worked in the summers, 3 summers for the Vancouver Sun. So that really, that gave you an extra sense of the dimensions to Vancouver at that time.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, if there's any place that's home, you know, it would be, other than here, it would be Vancouver.
Yeah, and so how often do you get back here?
Well, actually fairly often, because I still have really good friends here, you know, in Vancouver.
Yeah.
And actually, yeah, so I would say I'm there every few months. What with one thing and another.
Yeah. The circumstances which bring you to Appledore, this place just outside of Winlaw. When was, because I was reading the book and I thought it was just recent, but as I'm reading the book, I realize that it's about almost 30. Or, is it about 30 years?
Yeah. Yes. It was 1989 that I decided to move up here, and really it was the whole idea, as I try to make clear in the book, is it was kind of trying to take the geographic cure from a relationship in the sense that I couldn't seem to resolve it, either to stay or go, and I thought by getting out of town it would give me a perspective, and so in 89 I moved up here just intending to basically stay a year and kind of sort out my life. And for reasons that I go into in the book, I picked the West Kootenay area, but with one thing and another, I've stayed on here for, yeah, it's more than 30 years now.
Yeah. And so you were in a long-term relationship with B. I guess I'm wondering, in retrospect, did you think the physical separation, her remaining in Vancouver, you being there, would either end the relationship totally or perhaps bring you back together again? I mean, those are one or two options, I guess, and that's what you're hoping to realize, say?
Yeah, I think I think that was in the back of my mind. You know, I was a lot younger then, so not as smart as I am now about relationships and stuff. But that was kind of my plan. If it sounds a bit desperate, I hope that gets across in the book that we really were caught, stuck, as the counselors will call it, like stuck. We couldn't go forward, and we couldn't seem to end it. Any relationship involves, of course, two people, so it's not like one of us is a bad person and the other a good person. It's always a mix of people's attitudes and behaviors and stuff like that. But anyway, we were definitely stuck, and so almost any move to try to break up that stuckness, was my thinking, would lead to some kind of resolution.
But as you write in the book, you remained friendly throughout all of this, and while B remained here in Vancouver, you kept in contact because you had an uncle that you were both, say, looking after. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah. And just because it wasn't, in terms of not being able to get along, like I talk about, I had a huge part in why that wasn't working. I've always been kind of the expert on a double message, which is let's get close, let's keep our distance. And of course, double messages are quite frustrating to the other person in a relationship.
Yeah.
And so I think in the book, at least I hope, it's pretty clear that, the problem mainly lay with me. The problem mainly lay with me rather than with B. But nevertheless, it wasn't like a hostile situation at all. We both had, tons of affection for each other. It's just how to try to make it better.
Yeah.
Was the issue, or end it.
Yeah, and so you also talk in the book about seeking therapy, and you talk about Kennedy, a counselor, and then someone else named Piesta.
Yeah.
Is that how you pronounce it? You obviously, as you narrate in the book, learn a great deal from both of them.
Yeah.
Do you feel, looking back, the time that you spent talking to both of them and learning from both of them, that you were able to, say, achieve personal growth?
Yeah, I think so. I wouldn't say growth, because I don't know that I'm all that much better a person fundamentally.
Yeah.
But a much better understanding of why I behave as I do and what the consequences are to other people, which can be quite harmful as well as harmful to myself. So it's just working with these people who are very skilled at interpersonal relations, as I detail in the book, really helped me understand a lot more about how people interact and what the consequences are of my own behaviors. So I think I gained a lot of understanding. You'd have to talk to my friends to see whether I really am a better person. Which is the real way of judging whether this stuff is effective.
Yeah.
Like it's good for me because I understand more about myself. But what you really want to do is behave better towards other people.
And do you think you have, though? I mean, just looking at it as objectively as possible, having written this book now, this memoir. And considering the last 25 years, or more, it's 35 years now, pardon me, you obviously, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it seems like you've resolved a lot of the whatever you were worried about before. I mean, that's not to say you are without worry today.
Yeah.
But a lot of the issues of the past... I think you found what you needed living where you live today.
Yeah, well, I think you could say like the book is in part about expanding awareness of not just personal behaviors, but of how to interact with nature and community and so I think that the relationship stuff, my relationship with other people, is just part of a kind of if you like, one of the characters in the book, Fred Dutoff, says like moving here from the city, he says, is a voyage of discovery. But, and I think that was really true for me. And he meant discovering the differences between kind of living in an urban environment, that culture, and living in a rural environment, that culture, was what Fred was talking about. But I think it applies to, you know, many aspects of, at least of my life. But when I say you have to check with my friends, is that, they're never shy about telling me about, you know, ways I'm behaving that, you know, they think fall short. I'm sort of used to feedback.
Yeah.
And I know, you know, I always try to be the best person I can, but there's still lots for me to learn and grow. But the book itself is kind of, a record of that. As I say, like of what Fred Dutoff called a voyage of discovery, in terms of coming here, discovering things about myself, discovering things about the natural world, about how a community exists and functions. And I'm sure your next question would be, well, couldn't have you've done all that in Vancouver? And I guess the short answer is yes, but it's because of a smaller population, because of the closeness to nature, because of just the accidents of my life, this is where it happened for me, and that's what I wanted to record in the book.
Yeah. Considering, you know, the way that I live here in Vancouver and the way that you describe your life in just outside of Winlaw there, it seems like it's a lot of chores, a lot more chores than, say, I have to do here. Lot of us that live in apartments, I don't live in an apartment, but, you know, I know a lot of people who live in apartments don't have to do a lot of the things that probably you have to do on a daily basis, let alone seasonally.
But they're rewarding. You know, to eat food that you've grown yourself, to have flowers and houses that you've raised. Those are all pluses. So the chores aren't odious. Plus, I can't remember if I said it in the book, but one reason you garden here is because during the season of gardening, that's the number one topic of conversation. Like if you meet people in the post office or something, you know, they'll say, well, how are your tomatoes doing? And you know, in the way that other people would talk in a different situation, to talk about the weather or how are the Canucks doing, or, you know, it's the whole thing of gardening becomes a connective tissue in the community. And if you don't garden, if you didn't garden, you wouldn't have anything to say. You know, it's like if you don't follow certain sports teams and people want to talk about that, you're kind of lost. And so, it's you can call it chores, but that always has a negative connotation. While it is work, it's also immensely rewarding and helps you connect with other people here and stuff like that.
The way you describe what you do in terms of the garden on a seasonal basis, in terms of what you grow, say, not just food you eat, but flowers, other foliage on your property, it's just quite beautiful. And when you talk about a moment ago about expanding awareness, that awareness of, say, the outside world that a lot of us in cities lose sight of, I think is important, and that comes through in the book. I guess you weren't much of a gardener before you moved there, right?
No. I think I mentioned in the book that Dee, my partner in Vancouver, was a master gardener. She'd taken that course at Van Dusen Gardens,
which
certified you as a master gardener, and so that was like her preserve. We had a rented house for a while in East Van, and she just transformed the backyard into a, you know, just a wonderful garden. But I had, you know, virtually no interest in that. That was sort of her preserve. I would help out, you know, if she wanted something carried somewhere from this part of the garden to that part of the garden. But it wasn't until I moved here that I started to get interested in it for the reasons that I talk about. Yeah. It became pretty clear that if you didn't use the land in that way, you were really shutting yourself off from one of the reasons for being here.
Yeah. You also talk about the interactions with animals, bears especially. I mean, I found that fascinating in the book. You really do have to coexist with the other creatures that live in that valley there, the deer especially.
It gives you a much better sense than you can get, I find, in the city of just, how interdependent we are with these creatures. And, it's hard to have a huge ego if you're face-to-face with a bear, because, of course, the bear's not too impressed with, all your accomplishments in the human realm. And so it does tend to keep you humble.
Yeah. There's a couple of moments in the book that I laughed out loud. I guess you were having trouble with a bear entering your property. I can't remember the details now, but you put up a sign. And I can't remember even now what the sign says, but you suspected that the bear could read the sign.
it was just in the fall when the bears are fattening up, they're just all over the valley. So, and they tend to crash through fences rather than go around through a gate. So I'd had a fence that was constantly smashed, and finally I just left one of the boards missing and put up a sign saying "Bear Gate," hoping that the bear would, behave accordingly. And then, as I talk about in the book, found that a neighbor who had a very large apple tree, and the bears would go up and just make a mess of it, break branches and stuff, and then he put up a ladder with a sign that said "Please use," but the bears, of course, couldn't read or wouldn't follow instructions.
And then you're rushing about one day in outside, and a young bear is there, and you shoo it away, and it does, these things can go sideways, but I mean, in that case, that interaction that paid off for you, didn't it?
Yeah. Well, I should stress that the bears around here aren't like giant, the bears on the valley floor aren't like giant grizzlies or something. Sometimes these bears are not much bigger than what you would think of as a big dog. Mm-hmm. It's just that they're immensely powerful. And so, you want to treat them with respect. But I had to cut some of the bear stories out of the book, because I can talk about, there's hardly an autumn goes by that there isn't a strange and interesting interaction with bears. I'll just give you one that's not in the book. I was talking to my neighbor just outside the house here one day, and we looked up suddenly, and a little bear had come around the corner of a fence that I have between it, my place and the neighbor's. And it was weird that the bear showed up, because I was talking to the neighbor. It wasn't like the bear, didn't know we were there, but it stopped and seemed startled that we were there, and just sat there. But it was so non-threatening that I went back to talking to the neighbor. And the bear, after a while, seemed miffed that we weren't paying attention, and turned around and scampered off through the woods. But it's just odd. You don't know, what a bear will do or won't do. I have that line in the book where I talked to the Alberta writer and former park warden Sid Marty, and asked his advice about how best to handle these interactions, and Sid's reply, as I have in the book, he just said, "It's up to the bear," which is more or less true.
Yeah.
My neighbor, for example, again, I think this was cut from the book, but he, in faced with a bear on his property, he'll run at it. Because he says, nine times out of ten, they'll just turn and run if something is heading towards them. But, I'm too much of a coward to do that, because what if it's the one time out of ten? Bear takes offense. But he's got a lot more self-confidence around these animals.
So the thing that people listening to us who haven't picked up the book yet might think is that this was a stark adjustment to your life. But in the earlier part of 35 years ago, you were commuting elsewhere to work, to teach, Calgary and elsewhere. So you were away from the property a while as well, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the problems of rural life is that, you know, while you might enjoy the lifestyle, the number of jobs is very finite, right? So lots and lots of people work away. Say my neighbor next door used to go up for a couple months a year to the oil patch to drive truck, and the plumber that's mentioned in the book as one of the characters, Wolfgang used to go up to the oil patch, and you know, I think he said once he could make as much in a month up there as he could make in the rest of the year down here.
Right.
So the idea of working away is remarkably common, just because of that shortage of jobs.
Yeah. It's, so, do you still teach?
No. I retired in 2010. I've been retired quite a while.
Yeah.
I taught in Calgary. I enjoyed very much the people I worked with, but I sure didn't like the city. And so the first chance I got, I worked there 8 years and that was enough. So I called it quits and came home.
Yeah.
And I've been here full time ever since.
Yeah. So when because you are alone for a lot of the time, one would think it's a great environment for writing. Between the work that you have to do outside your house, in the garden and the sort, what's your day like in terms, and how much time do you get to write, say?
Yeah, well, I mean, I set up a schedule so that when I'm at home, I'll work at the desk until around 2 o'clock or 3 o'clock,
mm-hmm.
and then I go outside and work in the garden for... you know, until dark, if you like. So in the spring, as the days are getting longer, I can work till 6 or 7, sometimes 8, if I'm really behind in the garden, then come in and have supper and go to bed. But that, even in the winter, it's the same idea. Like, I'll work till 2 and then either go for a ski on the rail trail or if there's... snow clearing to be done, that's generally when I'll do it. That's the schedule. Of course, it changes around. I got into the habit during the pandemic of going into town every Thursday, so doing all my town shopping on one day and meet with friends for coffee in the morning. That was our kind of connection, even during the pandemic,
mm-hmm.
like following all the protocols and so on.
Yeah.
But still, the coffee shop that we liked in Nelson had remained open. So that's a Thursday is a very different day than that pattern of working, working at the desk until early afternoon and then being outside. Before the pandemic, I would sometimes not go into town till after working on the desk, but currently I just put all that off till Thursdays and take sort of the whole day as what they call around here a town day. It's about a 45-minute drive into town from here, so it's a bit of an expedition.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, mm-hmm. if you're on one side of Vancouver and trying to make it to the other, it can take 45 minutes. So
that's true, yeah.
It's not totally, out of line.
Yeah. You mentioned your neighbor a moment ago, and you talk about your neighbors in the book. So where your house is, how far is the closest neighbor, say?
Yeah, well, I'm on a 9-acre parcel, and so is the neighbor. And these are subdivisions from even larger parcels that, say, were laid out in maybe the 20s or 30s.
Uh-huh.
But these two houses, as I talk about in the book, because my house is a product of a divorce, it's actually only 80 meters from the other house. So not that far, like 80
yeah.
yards. Which is unusual in like it's these two houses are remarkably close. in this area. There's usually more distance between houses. But because the guy who had originally built the house next door was building a house for himself after a divorce, you know, he just sort of didn't want to be that far away.
Yeah.
But I've enjoyed really quite wonderful neighbors who've all become friends. That place has turned over a couple times since I've been here. But for one thing or one reason or another, managed to be good friends with the folks next door, luckily,
yeah.
because two houses are so close.
And then there was a situation where there was a neighbor a little further away who was a source of great consternation, a lot of noise for all of you, right?
Yeah. A guy came in, bought a place, and then built a heavy equipment repair facility, which was, shall we say, not in keeping with the neighborhood. But he had grown up here in the days when there was a lot of distance between houses. So I think he was thinking that even though he might make a lot of noise, it was still going to be far enough from the neighbors. But actually, he was very, very close to two neighbors of mine, and I'm a little further away, but still enough to be bothered. So that was kind of, in many ways, a culture clash. But as I mentioned in the book, it all ended happily, but at least happily for us. But it was certainly a concern. But yeah. it also was a learning experience. Like, I don't think I would handle things the same way again, just having learned that often troublesome people don't stay, that the same attitudes that lead them to be a problem for their neighbors lead them to have problems in the rest of their life too. And so I've watched, not so much here, but with other friends who've had, you know, suddenly there's a problem, and then two or three years later that problem evaporates. But at the time that this happened to me, I didn't have that perspective. So, again, it's living here, you learn a bunch of stuff. And, looking back, I think that was true in the city, too, that, you know, you might have a noisy neighbor, but it's just kind of weird, but they don't stick around. It just makes the year or two that they're bothering you really unpleasant. but if you can have some patience, they generally are have a pretty jangled life. You know, the fact that they are so inconsiderate really is demonstrated in the rest of their life. So sooner or later, things collapse for them and they're gone. But it takes a lot of patience to endure the short-term agony or unpleasantness.
Well, were you always patient?
No. I think a lot of patience comes with experience, and I think young people tend to be impatient.
Yeah.
And you know, when I was young, it was I was involved, as I talk about in the book, you know, with radical movements, and you know, we were very impatient about wanting to see you know, major social change right away. And one thing about living in community out here is you get a much better sense of how a community operates and why change is so slow. You know, how many people not only are invested in how things are now, but are fearful of change. Like, you know, that idea that all change is change for the worse is pretty deeply rooted in people. And so, yeah, you want to be cautious about how to make change and make sure that, you know, it really is beneficial. It's just something I think that you gain over time.
Yeah.
And if I can link it to the book, I would say, you know, for a couple of times I was involved on the union side with contract negotiations.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, you come in, you've got this whole list of things that, you know, of course you're right, these are all changes that the workplace needs, but you quickly realize that you're not going to win everything on one contract. So, you know, it's more incremental. You win some things this time, and when the contract expires, you renegotiate and win some more things. But when I was younger, I would have thought, no, you go for everything. You know, otherwise it's not worth doing. But like I say, over time and over just watching how people respond to change, even change that can be beneficial to them, they're still dubious with just that sense that all changes change for the worse. I had a friend who was, for a while, this is in the United States, he was CEO of a company that had a little device that moved large amounts of electricity very, very quickly, and it had some applications in medical stuff and military stuff, and they would try to sell this to companies that were using different means of moving a lot of electricity very fast. And he points out in his book that just because it's better doesn't mean people will adopt it.
Mm.
I found that an interesting idea that, you know, even in business, a better procedure or a better piece of equipment doesn't automatically mean people will go for it. You have to show them why it's better. You have to convince them as well as showing them. And I think that's true with social change, too, or neighborhood change of any kind.
You mentioned in the book that you get a lot of visitors. I shouldn't say a lot, but a number of people come and visit. And sometimes just as one group leaves, another is coming up the drive. When they come and they stay with you for whatever, however much time they do, I'm assuming that they come from elsewhere, different kinds of lifestyles. Do they ever visit and say, you know, the way you've got it set up is something that I'd like to pursue myself? I mean, do you convince people of the way of your lifestyle?
I mean, I don't try to convince them, but people do like it. Constantly in Nelson, you'll meet people who say, much as my experience was, I came here expecting to be here for a short time, or I came here expecting to be for a visit, and all these years or decades later, I'm still here. There is a kind of magical aspect to the West Kootenays, if I can say that, whereby, you know, it's just remote enough, it's just beautiful enough that some people fall under its spell and want to stay here. But with most people, they're engaged in their own life elsewhere, and even if they have a momentary wish, say, geez, you know, I'd really like to live here. For most people, they don't follow through. Again, it's not in the book, but one anecdote I can tell is about longtime friends here who, if someone who visited them really liked it, when they went back to the city, they would say, can you send me real estate information? And they found through experience that they would wait till people asked for real estate information twice, because the first time was like an impulse, and it would eventually die out when they got sort of back in their city life. But if they asked for that information twice, it showed my friends that they were more serious about exploring living here, and then it was worth my friends, you know, gathering handouts from local real estate folks and passing it along. But I thought that story, which I say is not in the book because you can't tell everything, but it kind of shows the answer to your question, which is people can be momentarily enthusiastic because it is such a beautiful part of the province and probably the world. But that they get, people are, you know, pretty deep in their own lives, and once they're not on holidays, you know, their regular life comes crashing back in, and you know, pretty soon they're this is just a memory kind of.
There's a scene in the book where you're standing outside of the house, and you're looking at your surroundings there in the valley. The last 35 years, has it changed all that much?
No. That's what keeps me here, really. Because you know, I'm getting older, and there's always health implications.
Sure.
As you get older, for staying here, like if I lose mobility, I don't mean vehicle mobility, but just physical mobility, I couldn't stay here. There's just It's not just the upkeep, but it's distance from, you know, medical attention or just how much effort is required to just do minimal kinds of upkeep. So you do think about at some point, are you going to have to transition out of here and move to town, which, you know, some people do. But in that kind of, you know, because that sort of goes through your brain, you're constantly thinking, well, am I still enjoying being it here? And
yeah.
I have to say the answer is still yes. It's still a wonderful place, not just in terms of the physical beauty, but you know, I like a lot of the people around here, and because they come from so many different backgrounds, they're constantly a surprise. On just two examples from this past weekend. On Saturday, I was up, because it's National Poetry Month, giving a group reading in Silverton, which is a town about half an hour drive or a little more from here.
Yeah.
And afterwards, I was having a glass of wine with some people, and the guy who owns the general store, well, it's actually a building supply store, but it's run like a general store in Silverton, began to talk about his background. And God, he had degrees in design, construction design. He had degrees in philosophy. His story about how he ended up owning officially a building supply store in this hamlet, smaller than Winlaw, which is pretty fascinating, just the kinds of flips in people's lives. But if books were mentioned, you know, he'd read more than I had. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Just an interesting person. Yeah. Then on Sunday, yesterday, I was out to, there's the Valakon Hole Community Center, which is kind of like the hippie community center in this area, which I talk about in the book. But there was a performance by a brass ensemble and a string ensemble, both doing classical music. Most of the music in Valakon Hole, of course, is rock and roll or its modern equivalent.
Yeah.
But this was a classical concert. And it was just fascinating, like how good it was. A mix of amateur and professional musicians. And by professional, of course, that's not here. Like, one person was with the Kamloops Orchestra and somebody else with the Okanagan Orchestra. But they live here much of the year, and together with, you know, really talented amateur people have these ensembles. And yeah, and again, not just the kind of cultural angle being available here, but also just talking to people in the audience that I knew and their backgrounds. It's kind of a delightful life,
yeah,
here. So, I mean, the short answer to the question is, yeah, I'm still enjoying it.
Yeah.
How long I can do it will really depend on health.
Yeah, there's a character in the book that you call Mrs. Barisov.
Yeah.
How long has she been there, and how long did she live there?
Well, she's still, the character on which that person is based, is still here, and there's an easement across this property from the, you know, to this property for the water line from the easement that's signed by her and her husband in the 1980s, but I'm certain, because she has a Duke of Bourbon name, that, you know, she's probably been on that property since the 50s or 40s.
Really?
And that's true of other people around here. It's a real mix of folks that were born and grew up in the valley, and then people like myself that have come, and that's still going on. You still meet one of the people who was reading on Saturday night at Silverton. She had just 2 years ago moved down from Golden, and before Golden had lived in Calgary. And so that you still get that thing of young people on the move, and they discover this place, this is great, they stay for a while, and then the question is how long. And so you just meet people that have been here a variety of lengths of time, and Therefore, they have very different insights on the valley. But almost always their lives are pretty interesting in terms of their background and what they've done with being alive. And I know that's true in the city, too. It's just that with a smaller population, I find you have access to a broader range of ages and a broader range of social economic background. In the city, I mostly ran with people that were very much like myself in terms of age and in terms of, you know, socioeconomic background. But here, you just meet folks from all kinds of backgrounds. I have to say, that was one thing I liked about journalism. You know, I started off, as I say, on the Vancouver Sun, was at least with journalism, you were constantly interviewing people with different backgrounds and different ages. But in the rest of my life in the city, it was pretty pretty narrow slice of the demographic. Whereas here, just because of the smaller population, you're constantly meeting people that, certainly in the city, I wouldn't have had have a chance to have met and gotten to know.
Tom, you know, I can't tell you, talking to you now these past few minutes and having finished the book, just how much I enjoyed this insight into to your life, your these past few decades of your life and the place that you live in and the place that you obviously care about a great deal and the people around you. I'm sure there'll be people who will read the book and want their own Appledore for themselves. It's a wonderful way to think about where one's life is and marvelous lessons, obviously, that one can glean from your book. I so enjoyed the book and our chat today. I so appreciate your time, Tom. Thanks for this.
Well, thank you. But, I mean, I have to say that when we were talking beforehand, you expressed a kind of affection for East Van and the folks that you know there. And so I don't want people to think that, like, this is the answer or... It's just an answer, and I think, you know, people can have their own Appledore even in East Van. It's not exclusively a rural thing. But I did one, among other things, to just show people, if they are thinking about moving to the country, that it is different than the city in some pretty significant ways. It's not just urban life with more scenery.
Yeah, it's difficult too for people listening to us. Tom narrates in at least two chapters the difficulty with water he encountered, and I think that, you know, that's something that those of us that live in cities had rarely contend with.
But you've got to contend with crime, for example.
That's
true.
Which
is almost non-existent here. I mean, it's always trade-offs, I guess.
But it's a wonderful way to think about where one's life is and what they need more of. Whether it's a lot of us, you know, could do with some solitude, and I think if we can find it, I'm sure I'll find it in Vancouver. You know, so much that we'd be so much better for it, right?
Well, that's an interesting way of thinking of the book. I hadn't thought about that, but that. The book as an idea or a chance for people to think about, you know, what do they want in their living, you know, in their living situation.
I certainly mean, we're talking here, it's the middle of April. You talk in the book about the seed situation, where you get your seeds and when you start planting. I like green onions. And so I have noticed over the years how the price has just seemingly increased. I mean, you can't get a bunch at a grocery store in Vancouver for less than a dollar now. You know, I could start my little, planting my own, you know.
Yeah, just with a window box. Actually,
right,
you could
grow
enough green onions to satisfy you for the whole summer.
So I mean, you know, that's one of the lessons I'll come away with. Tom, again, we'll talk soon. I so appreciate your time today.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
The website for more is at tomwayman.com. The book is called The Road to Appledore, or How I Went to the Land Without Ever Having Lived There in the First Place. It's from Harbor Publishing. Tom Wayman joined me on the line from Winlaw, British Columbia in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.